Well, it is a great pleasure here in Lampeter to meet Yvonne Howard. Now, Yvonne, wonderful to have you on the podcast, because I think I first met you must have been about a quarter of a century ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a long time ago. And that would have been in this very building, I think, where we are now.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So yeah. Now, I can't wait to hear all about your life and adventures. But am I right in thinking that the journey started? Well, two things. First of all, I know we're going to mention Leeds in a moment.
That's right, yeah.
But also, of course, when I first met you, you were, was it a British Academy scholarship?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, and that was wonderful, really, because it gave me the opportunity to pursue my interests further, yeah. Really. So I came to Lampeter, but my research area was actually in East London.
Yeah.
So it was about the communities and all the different conflicts and neighbourhood mediations that went on there, because my work has always been within building relationships between people. It's about boundaries, artificial boundaries and borders that people create, and people feeling that they're different from one another when they have many things in common. And it's just about understanding these things.
And sometimes I find that it's when you think you know someone, or you knew someone at the age of, I don't know, 20, and then 30 years later, you know, you might still be in touch with them, but actually it's the people who were in the background, or the mm-hmm. people who were the secondary or tertiary friends, mm-hmm. or the friends of friends. Mm-hmm. And then 30 years on, suddenly you realise that you have the most amazing sort of, you know, things in common. But you know, there's a time and a place. It's something like out of Ecclesiastes, but you know, there's sometimes that's just the way it works.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need to have had some life experience, or you need mm-hmm. to have been to different places and had life experiences of your own. Mm-hmm. In order to sort of find where those points of connection are, and also some of those people that you think you'll be friends for life with. My children are primary school age, and of course they talk about the friends they want to marry and all that. And of course, in reality, you know that's probably unlikely to happen. But anyway, so there's a bit of Lampeter there. But am I right in thinking then that did you grow up in Leeds?
I did grow up in Leeds, and yeah, it was quite complex, really, my childhood in many ways. And so Leeds was, it's a beautiful place. I love all the historic buildings, and I went there a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, I took lots of photographs, and I found that I'd walked 20,000 steps, and because I kept stopping, walking a bit further, seeing another beautiful historic building and taking another photograph. But going back to Leeds now is very different than it was initially going back, because my childhood there was quite difficult, and my mother was a white woman, and we grew up in a single parent family, and it was just a very difficult time. We were very poor, and there were times that we didn't even have bread. And in some ways, my mum, she had her childhood was one that she could play the piano, she could read any piece of music, and she was classically trained in music. And I'm still looking into where that all came from, because it wasn't something that she learned in school. But she never really achieved her ambition, because she did have a very difficult time. And I did watch as people sometimes slammed doors in her face and spat in the street. And that was really difficult for me. So I took to writing, and I turned a lot of the difficult things that I saw and that happened to me as well into words, and that supported me, these memories and these journals. And when I first went back to study, really, and to do a degree in East London, I thought I could open these journals and look back on my life, but I opened the pages and I just had a glance and I just closed them. Yeah. And I knew that I probably could never do that.
Yeah. Mm. But sometimes it can be empowering when something that may at the time have felt difficult, challenging, shameful, whatever, you know, due to particular societal, cultural mores, standards of the day. And you can look back now and say, you know, how dare they? Or, you know, the thing, I was talking to my dad the other day, he was talking about being at school in the 1950s, mm-hmm. and he said it was just normal that, you know, you walk past the teacher, and if you're going too fast or too slow, or, you know, you just get the cane or something. Mm-hmm. And he said they'd be in prison today for doing that. And you're thinking, well, that's really interesting, because it's easy for us to look back and think, oh, you know, that person was horrible, or that episode from school was traumatic. But also there's a sense of, well, from the point of view of the person who was doing that, because they may have passed on, and we were, you know, many decades later, but you think, well, you know, people should be and are accountable, you know, for a lot of what happens. And the things that you could have got away with 50 years ago, you can't get away with now. And there must be a part of you that also must think, well, hang on, those things were awful, but rather than think, you know, that this is awful, difficult, challenging, shameful, it can be sometimes now, you know, you need to in some way tell the story, because that there has to be an outlet for that in some way, because you never, you can't pretend, nor should you try to pretend, that none of that ever happened.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is really about having a core group of friends that you trust and share it with. But for a lot of my early life, I didn't have that. So, as I say, I turned to journals and diaries, and then that helped me understand and see the conflict that was within nature, and you know, and that just, you know, as I say, if you part the leaves, you part the grasses, and you see small insects fighting for life, air, for space, for food, and you know, I related that to human beings, and so that meant that how people treated me wasn't so much because of me, but it was because part of perhaps a human condition. And about resources, and that led me into my studies later, because I left school at 15 in order to put food on the table, and I left with no qualifications, and I worked in Mills Singer sewing machine factory, and even a place called Batty's Brushworks, where I banged the heads on the top of brushes. But I did return to education when I was 29. And I took a CSE then, and then an access course. And on the access course, it was really interesting, because when the first day that I walked in, there was a large oval table, long oval table. And it was like all the black people were on one side as each one came in and joined the other, and all the white people were on the other. So I walked in the room and I thought, where shall I sit, kind of? And so I sat, for, you know, near the sort of end and somewhere kind of a bit in between. But then I talked to everyone. So I ended up becoming Access Student Rep. And it also gave me my topic of study, because which was about conflict and relationships and differences between people, or perceived perception of difference. And so that led me into everything I do today. So it was, in a way, it was my childhood. It cannot be separated out from what I did and what I do now. It was a pattern of life, because I saw so many things as a child in terms of a treatment of my mother, and also myself, what I experienced as I went through life. I just wanted to understand people. So it was almost inevitable that I'd explore sociology, psychology, anthropology. And so all of these things that I built into I think it was one of the first in University of East London, a degree by self-managed learning. And I was able to package this together. And part of that included autobiography, and it included biracial people as mediators throughout time and history. I looked at my mother's experience as a white woman who crossed the line, and to some extent, some family members rejected her for that. But then later on at 15, I went to live in a mining community, because I took a stray dog in and we loved him so much, and that we got evicted from our home. So an auntie found us somewhere to live in a mining village and near Barnsley. But when I went there, I couldn't quite understand the beautiful, rich tones of the Barnsley accent. I can speak it very well now, but then I couldn't understand, and I'd say to my mum, what are they saying? And it would be like, "Hey, are you coming out, Danique?" And that's just, "Hi, hello, are you coming out tonight? Or do you want a slice of cake? Or how's Babby? You know, how's the baby?" And, you know, he was just, but it was just, it's beautiful. It's really beautiful. And so I lived there for a while, and then moved back to Leeds. and to Chapel Town, Leeds, really. And it was really interesting because, you know, I first discovered that area when I was about 15, and Potter Newton Park and that area then, and got to know my dad some more, you could say. anyways.
Do you know, I was just thinking, because you mentioned that you were 29 when you went to full-time into education, but in a way it's the opposite journey to me. Mm-hmm. However, you know, I was saying a moment ago that sometimes the people who maybe we were close to once, we're not so close to now, and people we weren't so close to, we are now. In the same way, I went to university at 18. I did ticked all the right boxes, but I knew that I lacked life experience. Yes. I mean, totally. So in other words, theoretically, I could say, oh, I've done this. I know all the theoretical constructs. I could write a good essay. All of that is true. But I'm at a stage in my life now, in my 50s, where I'm like, that's great. I've done all of that. But there are missing bits. Mm. And if those missing bits mean coming out of the profession that I've been doing effectively, went into higher education at 18 and never left, then I have to do it. But it sounds like, and there are many other people, including people I've interviewed on this podcast, who left school early or, you know, didn't get a degree. Maybe in that sense, you know, they were doing the sort of work that is very different from what they're doing now. But it made them all the more eager, the more hungry, the more disciplined, because they knew what they didn't have, mm-hmm. and they had to fight harder to get it, and they would never relinquish it. So in a way, there may be an point where there was something perceived to be missing, but you have more than compensated since. And if anything, I feel I'm almost going the other way. In other words, there are bits, that life experience, I may not have had it at the age of 18, mm-hmm. but I can't go my whole life kind of without it. That is a fascinating story.
I think in many ways we meet in the middle. And a presentation I did with Gary once, I spoke quite a bit about those different experiences, because there is theoretical understanding, which sometimes people straight into university and then straight working out in a field. But one of the things that I mention about is lived experience, theoretical understanding, professional work within a field, and friends and their work within the field. There is another one, but I can't quite remember it. Now, somebody could have all five facets. Somebody could have one or two. It's about like intersectionality, all the different things cross over, and each are informative, and they help piece the pie together, you could say. And so I think it's quite important to actually to be out there and to engage things, and to have people and friends who are within those things, that because we all create, help each other understand more, we explore further and dig deeper.
And you also do it in dialogue. Now, are you still in touch with many of the people from that era?
Not really, not too much. More so now. Yeah. You know, you're saying about the gap. Yes. Yeah, I'm sure we will be in touch, Mark. Yeah. And Wendy. So more so now. I think we go on journeys, don't we? Yeah. And we never quite know where that's going to take us and at what point that's going to open up. It's
No, I think that's exactly right, because sometimes I actually think that it's filling those gaps, mm-hmm. and sometimes you're aware of them explicitly, or you're aware of them through, sometimes it's like meeting somebody who may have done something or is thinking of doing something, and you think, hang on a minute, that could have been my story, or why didn't I follow that path? Or somebody might say to you very bluntly, and they've said it to me over the years, they say, oh, I thought you would have been doing blah blah blah, and you're thinking, well, that's interesting, because that has got to the very heart. It's almost like, oh, they've seen something that I almost, not so much didn't see in myself, but almost that wasn't the side of me that I thought I was projecting. And people say, oh yeah, you know, I just assumed that you'd be doing X, Y, Z. Mm. And sometimes you think, wow, you know, that person really gets you. And then that could be a spur. In other words, you can do that in dialogue, you do it in negotiation. But, you know, people, I've interviewed people as well for this who've talked about how, you know, they've grown up with people and followed different paths, but they need that route. They need that sort of sense almost that, you know, this is the path they were on, that person was on a different path, but they need each other to complement that sort of that counterpoint.
Absolutely, that's it. And that, like as you're saying about through dialogue, sometimes it's like words mean a lot. So one single word can set people off sometimes on a course of thought or action. And it can be also very motivating. I put up just an odd word sometimes, or a phrase that occurs to me. And no matter what I'm feeling like in a day, I'll just cast my eye upon that. And then it's almost like a choice. Sometimes I choose how to feel. I could stand up here now, and I might have had some bad news or something's happened. And then I can think about it, almost circle myself with that and think, right, I'm going to take a step to the left, out of that space, into another. And I find that works. And then I will go out and walk and photograph trees or something and completely. And while I'm doing that or doing something artistic and creative, I find that the mind switches off for a time. And in that switch off, it's recuperating, it's healing, it's rearranging itself.
Yeah,
and so in that is a kind of magic. We all have these tools around us, but sometimes a word from someone can, that's a journey that I'm going to build into my own. I didn't, as a child, I didn't know a lot of the right answers for things or the decisions. I didn't grow up in some homes where there's a sense of guidance, a particular kind of. I had a very loving mother, but guidance in a lot of things wasn't there. So I would learn through other people or what I'd see or what I'd read. I read a lot. And because we couldn't really afford books, so I'd go to the library or I'd read the books that the church gave us. And I'd see words on a bus and I'd watch a word or a phrase and I'd rush home as fast as I could, write it down and then look in the dictionary to see if I'd spelled it right.
Yeah.
And so words became my toys, crosswords, things that you didn't have to pay for. So it was all an evolution. Whereas if I'd have had maybe a lot of toys, I probably wouldn't have been thinking outside that box and inventing and creating for myself.
Yeah, and it's empowering when you can do that, because sometimes, you know, I did it through the radio sometimes, and I'd always have a dictionary.
Yeah.
And I realised how worn the dictionary would get, because, of course, I was always picking up and thinking, oh, I must get that, you know.
It's a journey, isn't it?
I mean, the internet has its advantages, but the days before internet, when you really had to make that almost pilgrimage sometimes to find something out and look it up, if it mattered that much, you would literally go to a library or you'd make a note of something and check it out. And that became a task, was these days, you can almost, while you're talking to somebody or listening to something, you can get all the answers you need. And that's good. But there always needs to be that drive, that discipline.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say hardship, but there is a sense, but there has to be some element whereby you earn the thing. It can't just fall into your lap.
Yeah. I find that when I'm writing something, when I'm writing a part of a story or a poem, I find that there's a word and I'm looking for a word, and or I want to get the word right, because a word can have so many similar meanings, but it might not be the right one. So I have to restrict myself, because I look for that word and go off on a journey, and it's just magical. And like you're saying, it is a pilgrimage, and it's a beautiful journey that you go on in the chasing of that word. So I could chase a word and where it'll take me for a day, which then, so sometimes I end up rewriting things, and it is so magical. It's just so empowering when you do that. I mean, I can't really use this word for that. So, because, for instance, I was writing about cats, and in those days, a lot of cats were called names like Blackie and Darkie. And so I thought, right, in terms of what I'm writing, I wasn't going to write that in this particular thing, but I wrote a whole piece on why, and I had to choose shall I or shan't I.
Yeah.
So so it all depends, really. So I might use it in the analysis of it, but I might not use it in that bit I'm doing. Maybe it's not appropriate, or it was a children or something, so I have to gently think about it. But that sent me on a whole new thinking in my head. There was all this discourse going on up there and another journey. So I'm writing a separate thing about the analysis of the writing as I write it. So it's a new journey, a new pilgrimage. So each thing's taking me somewhere else. And they ended up being called Trixie and Pixie for the moment.
Well, I so much to say on that, because you mentioned diaries. Uh-huh. Now, I've been writing a diary since I was young, but uh-huh. I used to write just a few lines here and there. And if I missed the odd day, who cared? Uh-huh. But now I write sort of 2,000 words a day, uh-huh. and it's built in, you know, uh-huh. and I do it either before bed or early in the morning. But I couldn't not do it. Now, to anybody else, to an outsider, that might be a sort of, well, you know, no one's making you do this. I know it's a lot of work. But if I don't do it, then there's something missing, because mm-hmm. you know that you're not going to get that opportunity back. As in, if you don't do it when you do it, that's it. The moment's gone. But when you write it, and even if nobody else ever reads it, although, you know, part of me, that's another thing, because I'm sure we'll talk about autobiographies and so mm-hmm. on. But when you do that, what you're really doing is processing, and I think that's what you yes. were saying, and yes. I'm happy to sort of go down that path with you as well, because you were talking about having, you know, journaling, having diaries, uh-huh. having an account of something, if something was traumatic, was difficult, was something that was from a period in your life when maybe things were not as you might like them to be. You mentioned the word conflict earlier, uh-huh. then you wrote.
Yes.
And I don't know if you're saying that you can't access anything from that era. You said you opened one of the pages and you put it back in.
Yeah. I suppose they were quite early diaries, and really, and probably up until my early 20s or something. There may be a time, because I have thought, oh gosh, maybe I'll have to burn them all or something one day. I'm not quite sure. I haven't come to resolution on that yet. And I don't want to think too quickly on it. But I do write today. I always write. Writing is my go-to. Yeah. It's my go-to for everything. I underpin myself. I manage my difficulties in life. And people who know me, I could be walking down the street and something comes in mind and I've got to find a pen or something, or I'd scratch with a stone because it's a word something, and I just have to get it down.
And does it have to be written? Does it have to be written, or can you do it on a computer?
Now that's quite interesting, because I didn't think that I was actually speaking a lot of what I create into the computer. I was writing as notes. I'm speaking mm-hmm. as notes. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realise, and it's only recently that I've realised I am actually recording things yes. through the phone, through the computer. So I'm actually writing my stories and things. But it might be a part of a story or a part of a poem, and then I want to go and to type or to write as well, because I enjoy bringing all the mediums together.
Yeah.
I enjoy handwriting, and I enjoy typing, and you get a different kind of yeah. writing, and it's sort of, and I enjoy talking some of it, and they're all sort of different and merged together, and so I enjoy all those things. It's like I like script writing, yeah. because in script it employs every aspect of the mind, and it's so challenging, and I love jumping into and out of characters and things like that, so I'm journeying with that as well. Which is a wonderful thing, yeah.
But that, I think you've hit the nail on the head, because in doing all of those things, you were finding the right medium, the correct medium for you mm-hmm. to deal with something where you couldn't necessarily mm. have used verbal speech, yes. you know, because there was a conflict situation, yes. And you found your way. But that was the right thing for you. And also it showed a level of, you know, dexterity, education, skill, also patience, of almost like, okay, you know, this is not okay, or this is affecting me, mm-hmm. so I have to have an outlet.
Yes.
And that outlet was words.
Yes.
Whereas some of the people causing the conflict probably wouldn't, well, they may have used words, but they wouldn't use them in a way that was perhaps as tidy or as, or how shall I put it, as erudite, or as, you know, as it clearly has been for you. So in other words, you sort of found your way through this and triumphed.
I found a medium for me. And it was it's a spirituality in a sense that I see everything. I always wonder about things, and I think about, you know, like we've got five senses or yeah. so it is said, but who knows how many senses we have? How do we state those things? So I think there's lots of essences, ways of feeling, and that sometimes can't always easily be explained. But in terms of diaries, it was my process mechanism, like yes. you were saying, and I took it all to psychology. psychology. So I read psychology really early. And in doing that, I can remember reading, oh gosh, what's going on now? It probably will come back to me. A really amazing book one time. And and it was all about how we can change and chart our own lives. Really. Power of Positive Thinking, Norman Vincent Peale. And I think I read it when I was about 15 or something, 16. And I thought, and that got me onto roads and looking at kind of, looking at, just different ways that we can shape things and change things. And so I realised, and because I'd always written biographical stuff, I thought, oh, and then I started to know what I wanted to do a little bit in life, because then I just wanted to work with animals and I wanted to write, and that was my, you know, or do things to do with injustice and because I discovered that I didn't like certain kinds of cruelty on people hurting people, and in school I was only quite short, but I found it difficult when people were being bullied in school, so I would get involved sometimes in that. And but some people that were having very difficult times, there's quite a few people that I know, they didn't make it in life and they couldn't continue with life. And so I always feel that I work with several people because they're all people who really tried and struggled to manage situations that they never managed to do. And so for me, writing has been my thing that's always works for me, and other forms of art I've discovered more recently.
Oh, well, we'll come to that, because I was going, do you think you could publish any of that?
Oh, absolutely.
Because my answer, don't ignore me completely, but when you said that you were in two minds as to whether to burn some of it, my inclination, and obviously, I'm just saying what my gut feeling is, that even if you could never look at it again, the fact that you've written it, the fact that it's there, perhaps it's of more use to somebody else who might say thank you, because everything that you've said to me so far, I'm sure that people even listening to this interview now who might be saying thank you, that is, you've said something that completely chimes and you've given me a direction, a way forward. You've shown me that there is a process mechanism. And also within that, also, it's not just, this is the crucial bit, it's not just from now in, 2024, thinking, well, I think this is what happened X number of years or decades ago. It's actually the first hand account. Mm-hmm. So memories can obviously sometimes deceive us. Memories,
they can,
we can bracket things out.
Yes,
we can, fake news, whatever. Of course, all that's
absolutely
true. Fake memory syndrome, whatever it's called, all of that. But what you wrote, the way that you process things, that to actually have that is majestic. It sounds like that is something which can really resonate, I would imagine, with people. So I'm in two minds, because I have written a lot of diary stuff. Mm-hmm, part of me sometimes thinks, why would anybody want to read this? But often that there are, it's a survival tool as well.
Of course.
And you're actually writing a survival tool book. Without knowing,
absolutely,
you don't do it for that reason, but you've got
you
it.
You don't do it, for, and it's so in a way, I feel. I suppose I was read a lot of stories and as a child by my mum on her lap, cuddling into her, and and sometimes. Times were very difficult, and we at times where we borrowed bread from neighbours. And I can remember my mother sort of lying in bed and saying, "Rub my arms," because she didn't eat the bread that we ate. And it's like, but she'd read lots of stories about animals and nature and things. So it was inevitable that that was part of my love of words and things, and everything sort of, moved on into that love of language. I loved maths because maths was again, it's like crosswords, and it was just a way of thinking, and it's something that I loved in school. I used to ask the maths teacher for homework all the time. Yeah. Probably everybody thought I was extra odd, but it gave me it. And and it was quite interesting because I found him about 40 years later. And I sent him a letter, and he was in hospital, and he only had 3 weeks to be with us. But he phoned me up, and he said, you went through a lot. I know you went through a lot. And I said, I didn't realise that you knew. He said, yes, you know, he did understand how difficult it was in school for me. And so, but that was a beautiful thing because he believed me in me so much in maths. Yeah, anyway, he was talking about mathematicians. Yeah. So, he believed in me so much that the belief in that tutor was one of the things that every time things got me down, I thought, I had that in the back of my mind. So as somebody who, you only need a person just to kind of believe in you and have some hope for you, and that can help carry you through. You can look back and think, I can do this, whatever, I can do this. We still get those thoughts in maybe when we can't, or maybe for some reason or other, but then we can hold on to those people who do believe in us and help us move forward.
And when that happens, I mean, I was always in two minds as to whether it was okay to return, even actually to Lampeter or to Sydney, to school friends, because there's a lot that is not okay. You know, there's a lot. You need to go away sometimes for a long time before you feel ready to come back. But when you've got that hook, when you've got that anchor, you've got somebody who can kind of make you see in yourself what you need someone to... Okay, put it bluntly. We all sometimes need someone to tell us what we ourselves almost don't believe you know we are capable of. And when you hear that sort of validation can be life affirming, it's humbling, it can be difficult to process, but my goodness, I mean it's an adventure.
And it's something that I believe in sharing out because one of the things that I like to do in workshops and working with people is that it's all about thought process, isn't it? And each of us can help each other move forward. And, you know, it's just that moment in time and the thing, one simple thing that we can hold on to and we can uplift ourselves and move forward. And whatever it is, I remember working with someone who was doing a painting and they put all these lovely colours on a page, on a thing, it was in mind actually, and then they put some very dark grey colour on top and they didn't like it. So I just thought, oh gosh, yeah, okay, right, what can we do? Because they wanted to do something different with it and wanted a different outcome. So I said, is there a lolly stick or anything around here? And so we just scratched that across the she scratched that across the page and all these beautiful colours burst through. It was, you know, and she had what she wanted. So she kind of changed that whole element and that moment, and it was empowering because we could talk about the feelings around that.
Because I sometimes feel that we forget that, you know, we may have changed, and it often takes other people sometimes to, you know, bring that side out of ourselves. Mm-hmm. That sometimes or maybe we haven't changed in the sense that the dreams that we had, we may have taken a circuitous path in life, but it's people can say, oh, I always liked your math teacher, always knew you were capable of ... But those other people, not the math teacher, because he was obviously one of the good people, but I often wonder, like bullies in school or something, you think, well, you know, you can remember 40 years on, you think, oh, that person was nasty. But I suppose I wonder, do they ever have any self-reflection? Do they care? Maybe they've got children of their own. Do they? Sometimes I find that some people have not changed, never will change. But occasionally you think, oh my goodness, you know, that's not what I... Or even with ourselves, you think, I could never have anticipated that things would have gone the way that they did. And because I was going to ask whether you've ever... Well, obviously, I'm sure you have been back to Leeds, but I found it with Lampeter. I had to go away for a long time because I said I didn't have great life experience at the age of 18. So I was sort of doing degrees here while also growing up effectively. But I had to go away for a long, long time before I felt ready to return because there was a lot that I was still processing in myself. I don't know if that is something that matches your experience of all the things that you were talking about earlier in Leeds and whether you face them now in a very sort of different way. Maybe you the dynamics have shifted since those early days.
Yes, I suppose that, the dynamics have shifted, I suppose, and I do... that's a complicated one, really, in a way. But I still I think I will always be underpinning myself in certain ways and seeking out new routes. But as I say, it's through writing or art and painting and creating something new. I also think sometimes people say they're not artistic, but conversation is art to me. I mean, everything is art, really. Yeah. And art is a tool for transformation. Yeah. And it helps us to know ourselves and know others and feel at peace with ourselves as well. I think we can find that it's dignified. It's a dignified thing. And, you know, it's when you bring that moment, it's moments of escape. It's, you know, everything is about us that we can use to actually help ourselves move forward in so many ways. Yeah. And I like to work with other people who are trying to move forward and make a difference, even in older years as well. I think, wow, I'm you know, going to get out now to do some of the things that I never managed to do earlier. I'm determined to, and I'm pushing back, really.
Pushing back in what sense?
I'm pushing back. I think there's in certain walls and certain things that I couldn't surmount. And if you can't get round the mountain and you can't dig under it and you can't climb over it, then, you know, build a bridge, do something. There's something sometimes. But we get that sometimes from other people as well as ourselves.
And sometimes it's the things that we suppress or we're just not ready to do them at a certain age. I found that I'm doing things now in my 50s that I always knew I wanted to do when I was young, but laughably so, like the 7-year-old me. I mean, I sort of remember that 7-year-old me, and you know, you're defined by your peers, and I suppose I was a bit of a loner compared to some of the other people, but I listened to them. Why were those people in a group? Because maybe if they weren't in a group, they couldn't cope on their own, and I was a better coper on my own. So I perceived myself in a sort of difference from them, in a negative way. And of course, if they're a group, you know, they might say, you might walk past them, and they might say things to you, which they would never say on their own, but they say it in a group. But you look all those decades later, and you think, hang on a minute. Well, actually, thank you very much. You know, what have I got to be so embarrassed about? Yeah. But also those quirks, and I have plenty of them, eccentricities. Whereas when I was young, I'd be aware and thinking, oh gosh, you know, people are laughing at me or whatever. Now I'm thinking, hang on, this defines me. If I didn't have that, well, goodness.
That's who you are today because of it. Yeah. And at the time, it's very painful, and we find ways to manage it. But it's always, I think it's, you know, it's always darker before the dawn, isn't it? And it's always the trees that, you know, we can't see what's outside if it's like we can see if we're surrounded by, you know, something, but you can't in the middle of the forest and that, you can't always see a way through, and it might not look like there is. But whether we like it, everything changes. There's nothing, as they say, what's that saying? There's nothing as constant as change. Everything changes. Whether you like it or not, you won't always feel like this.
Yeah.
You know, that is a thing we like it or not. You know, and so it's about sometimes you can't always change circumstance, and you can't always do things, but we can always, you know, have a kind of hope or try and find a tool, find a way that we can. Yeah. And I see, you know, I work with women, and I work, you know, in domestic violence situations, all sorts of things. So, it's all about moving forward.
And that notion of time as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the different Greek words for the time that, you know, we grow older, tick-tock time, but also the time when you're like, okay, the more sort of existential element whereby this actually, you have to seize control of it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I used to find beginning of term, or what I would feel, the beginning of term, September, you'd have the summer holiday and then you go back to school. And I, you know, that anticipation, because you've been through it before and, you know, there's a lot riding on it. You're thinking, oh, GCSEs or A-levels, whatever it might be. There's a lot on there. But now something has shifted because it's like if you go into a room and you're one of 100 people in the room, you can feel more out of place because you're sitting there thinking, you know, I'm just one of 100 people. How do I make my mark or whatever, you know, depending on the context that, you know, what are you there for? But if you're the person standing up in front of that group, well, you can, if you say something silly, well, you've got plenty of scope to correct it. Mm-hmm. If you're the person in the room and you ask a question and you say something silly, well, you may not get your chance back. Mm-hmm. So I'd feel more nervous sitting in a room with 100 people when I could be anonymous than I am when I'm actually facing people. And I suddenly realised I don't get nervous now at the start of term.
Yeah.
And yet, arguably, I'm putting myself completely in the firing line, almost, you know, because I'm there. Yeah, yeah. I'm potentially, I'm exposing myself.
Yeah.
And I could never go back to being the person in the room.
Yeah, who
would have thought that? It's completely lateral.
Yeah, but it's interesting because it just made me think of something else, like being that person up there. I knew when I first went back to study, and I knew that I was nervous in front of speaking up. In front of people,
yeah.
Because when I'd put my hand up in class, sometimes I was ridiculed and everybody'd turn and look at me and I'd get it wrong. Yeah. So I never learned anything about geography because I don't put my hand up anymore. So I knew that I had, and by writing autobiography, memoirs, journals, I knew that I was nervous about and shy about those things, but I wanted to do things that were out there and to, that would have involved me speaking in public. So one of the first projects that I did was exploring my own insecurity about speaking out in public. So my first essay I held on to, I spoke to a group and I said, as you'll all notice, my hand is shaking as I speak to you now. And it was amazing because there's so many other people who felt anxious about that, those things. But, it was that was a real change for me. And I went on stage, and I mentioned a bit before about the representatives, but that was the access course. But I also did it when I did the degree, and I had to speak to a lot of students, and I knew that something they needed to know about. And I wondered, I'd found in my autobiography that as a child, when lots of, some children weren't nice with little animals or things like, and I didn't like it, and I lost my fear. And I'd interfere and I'd say, leave it alone. Or if I saw something to a cat or something happening, I lost my fear. So I began to wonder. And so it got me into a lot of cognitive dissonance and all those different things and social psychology. But I thought, I wonder if I can pit my feeling of something happening that's wrong against my fear. So I walked out onto the stage and I said to the student union, I said, I might not be able to speak. Will you be there and just step in for me if I can't? And I stood there, all the students were there. And the bigger thing was that I wanted to say something to them because I didn't like what was happening. My mouth opened and I spoke. And it's never stopped since. Yes. So I broke a pattern. It's like, I won't go into detail on something, but sometimes working within children, and some children are shy to speak out, I found. And I said, oh, do you want to speak a little bit about something? And people are shy. And then suddenly they do. And I think that, wow, this, and, people say, are you pleased that are you proud that you got back to education and things like that? And I say, what I'm most proud about is that I'm part of somebody's enablement, that somebody who couldn't speak actually took hold of their own life and changed that at that moment. And you see it in the children and adults. That is something that I'm proud of.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like I was in London many years back, and somebody came up to me and asked, are you Yvonne? And I said, you're Yvonne. And I said, yeah. I said, do you remember me? But I couldn't remember. I was in community teaching at the time. I couldn't quite remember because you see a lot of people, don't you? And she says, I remember reading your story in the magazine, college magazine, and I thought about returning to learning access and what it had taken to get me there. And she said, and I stayed. I'm a lawyer now. Oh, sorry, I get emotional. And she said, I'm a lawyer now.
Yeah.
She stayed. And that's what I'm proud of, just being part of somebody else's journey.
Yeah.
Because that's something that, and that makes me, strengthens me. You know, a piece of paper can't do that in the same way.
Yeah.
It can't. You know, it's not, things aren't pieces of paper, they're journeys, aren't they?
Yeah.
So but it's just about if you can help be part of somebody's moving forward towards becoming themselves. Yeah. That's very powerful.
It is.
For me.
And the way that someone who might be, selective mutism, for example, and in some contexts, I know people very close to me who are in this, and they might have a particular fear of talking, or there are some situations which are just really awkward and you don't know how to navigate it. But then they might perform on a stage, like ballet. And you think, no one can match this. Yeah. And you think that's it. The reason that they're so brilliant on stage is because there's something else. You know, as you know, we can't be all good at everything. And yet, somebody can perform in one context and be streets apart from everyone else. And they may not be able to do the normal everyday stuff kind of thing. But you think, but wow, but it's you know, but they've got their skill and they harness it. And if they can show that off and if they can be the person they need to be, well, it's a price worth paying.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, there's this question. I've often talked to people about this in the context of autism and I'm clearly neurodivergent and I've interviewed people who are autistic and so on. And you think, oh my goodness, and it's incredible because in some areas, what might have been once be perceived in a disabling sense, like, oh, you have this label, you think, well, actually, but there may, you know, somebody who is neurodivergent may not be able to do some things that many other people, if not most other people, can do. But the things that they can do, that where their skill is 100 times sort of often in excess of others.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference between decades ago and now. Decades ago, you'd see the lack and think, oh, this person is, you know, they don't conform.
Yeah.
And education was like that. My goodness, if you couldn't sit still in a class, there's something wrong with you. Because you might actually have a medical condition now and you give one-to-one support, that person can thrive. On the other hand, you might be somebody who... you can be really proud of the fact that actually you do things differently from everyone else. So rather than be defined in separation from others, now you can say, yeah, the fact that I do things differently is actually exactly what has got me to where I am, and you can be really proud of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's about, like you say, a lot of science within like education, it's all about fitting a mould, isn't it? And even though sometimes, I mean, it's difficult, like the teachers, it's a really difficult job. They have to manage so many things. I don't know how they manage everything. And it's easy to actually, well, not easy, but it's difficult to manage everything and to work with all the different situations that arise with people. And so even though people mean well, there's not always the time and the resources for everything, and which is difficult because it's impossible, really, because, you know, children lose out, don't they, they might even excel at something. They might be twice exceptional. Everybody's got different exceptions, and everybody fits. And I think that's one of the things about, you know, when there's almost like a village or a community, then everybody's strengths and weaknesses can be accommodated. Nobody's strong and nobody's weak because everybody has something, even if it's helping others to think, even, you know, not necessarily participatory, but just being there, being present. So, but it's when people are in isolation trying to work through something, then it makes it more complex, I think, more difficult. Yeah. But it's about, you know, like you're saying about neurodivergence. Yeah. And that's what makes the world a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because look at the skills and the knowledge and the insights and everything that the world is bereft of if people aren't accommodated to becoming themselves. And it's like quiet people around the table and, you know, and then talkers. I control my talk because I want, let's say, the voices of everyone or the ways of communicating of everyone. Because if we don't, we're missing out on so much that we need. Everything needs to be at that table.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like you say, you know, we just have to find ways, new ways of communicating, and not making assumptions that this is the only way, because people often do that, and like visually or otherwise, seeing difference and not, you know, and make assumptions that people won't fit into this and that. But isn't that what challenges everything? And challenging everything makes the thinking grow bigger, and we end up with a bigger, more communicative space.
And I found growing up sometimes that there were things that we used to talk about in the playground at school. People talk about films they'd watched or something, and I didn't really do that kind of thing. Now I've certainly overcompensated for that now. But it's like when I'm watching something now that may have been talked about in the playground 40 odd years ago, or I remember, like, oh, maybe this was like really popular, you know, when I was 12. And now I'm watching it through the lens, or, well, I'm not looking through the lens of my 12-year-old self because I'm 51, but I'm watching it and it's all coming back and I'm thinking, now it all makes sense. But it's almost like I just wasn't ready for that conversation then. But now I'm almost like I needed to know what I wasn't doing in order to be able to do it on my terms.
Yes.
And now I'm like the people, you know, that the sort of people who, when they're younger, they do things in a way that, you know, they go out partying or they blah, blah. And now they're older and they say, oh, I have, you know, go to bed early and I do all these things. And I'm thinking, my life is so different. Mm. I used to worry when I was doing my PhD. Mm. I used to sometimes think, oh, that person's done more hours than me, or that person's always, you know, seems to be working hard, or I'm worried I'm not doing enough. And then you think, and it's ridiculous because now I know that no one does anything. You know, what I do is bespoke. You know, I spend a whole day at work. I go to the cinema. I write these reviews. I go to bed ridiculously late. I do my diaries, but I'm always fresh, open, alert. Fantastic. And it works.
Because but it doesn't work for anyone else.
Yes. And if I didn't do
the
that...
best you, then you're a better person than everyone else is for it.
Yeah.
Because you're being the best you. If you're a pain you by doing lots of other things that don't fit who you are, you are not giving your best self into the world.
Yeah.
Yet the more you are you, the better everything is and everyone.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, I've literally got a couple of questions as we start to wrap up. One is, I mean, in a way we've covered this, but it's that whole thing about whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. Those things that at the time you're like, uh-oh, this is not okay. But now, I mean, some of the things you were talking about, I bet you, and rightly so, are not going to be nostalgic about, but it may be the response to what happened, or the diary, that you think, oh, yeah. Like, it's not the thing itself. You're not going to be nostalgic about trauma. But the way you dealt with that trauma is something that you can return to again and again and say, okay, I have the mechanism, I have a coping mechanism in place that maybe could be a tool, you know, for other people. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I mean, yeah. It's like you say, you can't be positive about trauma in one sense, but you can't be positive about the process and the mechanism that developed from that, because I feel that I'm able to work with others and help other people, and, you know, and people can grow and learn together. So in a way that it's the shaping of it really, isn't it? And that processing. The process enables me to be a better person.
Yeah.
And to hopefully help others in my journey, and the way that I have managed things, and and to move forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also the Women's Institute you've been heavily involved with.
I definitely am. I became a member of the Women's Institute some years ago now, here in this part of Wales, and was the president of a local one for 3 years, and I'm now on the board of trustees at Shergar Carmarthenshire, and they're a wonderful group of women, and they're involved in so many things that try to make a difference in the community, and so we're just reaching out to people. So it's wonderful.
Fantastic. Well,
yeah.
My very last question, Yvonne, is whether you would consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Gosh, that is a big question.
Yeah. I always Exactly. And also, it's a naughty question because it's almost anticipating a binary answer. Mm. But I always finish my interviews with that question, and of course, what you said so far is perfect because you're right, it changes. But also, of course, the past, the present, the future. Mm. Are kind of interlinked.
I don't see them as separate, really. It's a bit like history, isn't it? We learn, we can, not everybody does, but we learn from history. Yeah. But it's like looking back at my studies then and looking at some of the things that have been studied today, and I can open that, and then I'm thinking, gosh, is that because some of the things are repeated. You know, almost like, but with different labels on or different names, which is quite interesting, really, how we can go around in circles sometimes. Yeah. So I think the past, present, and future do interrelate, you know, completely. And, you know, it's a bit like, you know, everything builds on something else, doesn't it? And then goes back again and keeps going. And I suppose that's part of life, isn't it?
Well, I have to say, Yvonne, this has been a tremendous adventure, actually, because I've learned, because I haven't just learned about you in the last hour, but I kind of feel as well that you've made me rethink things in a very cathartic way about myself. And so I'm so grateful to you, because I know it's been a while since we talked about possibly doing this interview, and I'm so glad that we finally got a chance to do it. So thank you so much for being my guest this week.
And thank you, because I have enjoyed talking to you. And, yeah, it's been fantastic and a lovely rapport. So thank you very much.